Welcome back. This is Alfred Wallace with the second half of the Decatur Herald and Review for Friday, April 8th, 2016. We will begin with the obituaries. Leslie Juno, Mount Zion. Leslie Sedell Juno, 68, of Mount Zion, passed away Saturday, April 3rd, 2016, at Lincolnshire Place. Services to celebrate Leslie's life will be at 11 a.m. Monday, April 11th, 2016, at Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home. Visitation will be for 1 hour prior to the services. The family of Leslie Sedell Juno is being served by the Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home, 2091 North Oakland Avenue, Decatur, Illinois. George Matherly Jr. George D. Matherly Jr., 74, of Decatur, died Monday, April 4, 2016. Services are at 1 p.m. Monday, Britlinger and Earl Funeral Homes of Decatur. Visitation is from 4 to 7 p.m. on Sunday. Burial will be at Friends Creek Cemetery in Argenta. Memorials may be sent to the American Heart Association. And condolences can be sent to www.britlingerandearl.com. Emma Rentmeister, Decatur. Emma Jean Rentmeister, 85, of Decatur, passed away Monday, March 14, 2016, at Heartland Manor Care. Private family services to celebrate the life of Jean Rentmeister will be at a later date. Burial will be in Hammond Cemetery. Memorials may be directed to the Alzheimer's Association. The family of Jean Rentmeister is being served by the Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home at 2091 North Oakland Avenue, Decatur, Illinois. Wilma Jean Tyus, Decatur. Wilma Jean Tyus, 76, of Decatur, departed this life on Tuesday, April 5, 2016, at Decatur Memorial Hospital. Services will be held at noon Saturday, April 9th, 2016, at the First Church of God in Christ, 217 East Decatur Street, with Pastor Mark Tyus officiating. Visitation will be 1 hour before service. Burial will be at Greenwood Cemetery. Professional service entrusted to Walker Funeral Service. Betty L. Weekly, Shelbyville. Betty L. Weekly, 88, of Shelbyville, passed away Tuesday, April 5, 2016, at Shelbyville Rehabilitation and Health Center. Visitation will be at 10 a.m. Monday, followed by a funeral service at 11 a.m. at Lockhart Green Funeral Home in Shelbyville. Burial will be at Greenwood's Glenwood Cemetery. Memorial contributions may be made to the St. John ELCA or Wesley United Methodist Church. Online condolences may be shared at www.lockhartgreenfuneralhome.com. Sammy Woodland. Sammy Woodland, 70, of Decatur, passed away on Sunday, April 3, 2016, in his own home with family at his side. Services to celebrate Sammy's life will be at noon, Saturday, April 9, 2016, at the Jasper Street Church of Christ, 950 North Jasper Street in Decatur, Illinois. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to services. Memorials are suggested to the Jasper Street Church of Christ. And Richard Woods. Richard W. Woods, 73, of Decatur, Illinois, passed away Monday, April 4, 2016, at his residence. Funeral services will be at 10 a.m. Monday, April 11, 2016, at Britlinger and Earl Funeral Home, Decatur, Illinois, with visitation 6 to 8 p.m., Sunday, April 10th, at the funeral home. Burial will be in Macon County Memorial Park, Harristown, Illinois, and memorials may be made to the American Diabetes Association. We will now have some news from the Decatur Tribune. Begin with Paul Osborne's City Beat, City Council and One-Year Evaluation of City Manager Tim Gleason. It doesn't seem possible that it has been a year since the Decatur City Council announced that Timothy Gleason had accepted the position of City Manager for the City of Decatur. The appointment was announced on March 16, 2015, and Gleason's first day of work was March 23rd. It's an understatement to point out that a lot has changed on the council since Gleason was hired. Three members of the present council, Bill Faber, Lisa Gregory, and Chris Funk, were not on the council that hired Gleason. Mayor Mike McElroy, an enthusiastic supporter of Gleason, passed away last July, and Councilwoman Julie Moore Wolf was appointed by fellow council members as the new mayor until next year's election. There has been no small amount of controversy on rezoning issues, gas tax, and especially the city manager's firing of Brad Sweeney, Decatur's chief of police. A judge should decide soon if the lawsuit filed by Sweeney to essentially get his job back has enough merit to proceed to trial. Public criticism of Gleason over the firing of Sweeney has been strong, especially on social media and in letters to the editor. Now it is time for the City Council to evaluate the job that Gleason has been doing, and that certainly may have been done in the closed session following the regular meeting Monday night. Because the wording on Item 8 of the Council agenda read, "Recess to closed executive session for the purpose of a discussion regarding the appointment, employment, compensation, discipline, performance, or dismissal of specific employees of the public body." City Council hired Gleason, and the wording of the closed session agenda item could have included his performance review. So that evaluation could have taken place Monday night, or should take place in the near future. Since the public is not part of a closed session, what goes on in there? Obviously, I have an idea of what goes on in an evaluation center about the city manager, because I chaired many of those closed session meetings during the years I served as mayor. I usually enjoyed it about as much as having a root canal without Novocaine, which I actually did once. When we held evaluation sessions, only the mayor and six council members were present in the conference room. No one else attended. We would talk about the strengths and weaknesses of the city manager, areas that needed improvement, and areas that had displayed improvement. Sometimes the discussion included whether the city manager deserved a raise for the job he was doing. Should his contract be renewed or extended? Or should he be told to start looking for another job? As I recall, the only public vote that would come out of the closed-door evaluations was anything that required additional expenditure of funds, such as a raise or an extension of his contract. The discussion and evaluation of the city manager was confidential, and not to be released to the public because it was part of his personnel file. Steve Garman was the city manager for about all of the time I was mayor, although I was part of the council who appointed John Smith as interim city manager until a permanent city manager was hired. For the last couple of evaluation centers I was involved in as mayor, we tried to evaluate every 6 months, we developed a form where each one of us could select one of five boxes that scored our evaluation of the city manager in several areas. Those evaluation sheets were given to me to compile scores and comments from all seven of us and give some kind of average. I appreciated the fact that the council members trusted me to go over their forms and present them with the results. They never challenged me as to whether I had altered their forms in any way, and of course, I didn't change anything they had scored or written. It was also my responsibility to meet with the city manager in my office and go over the overall evaluation of the council, without revealing which council members had scored him high, medium, or low. I thought that evaluation process worked the best of any we tried during the years I was mayor. Whether the evaluation session for city manager Tim Gleason was held Monday night, or will be held in a future closed session, or both, sometimes it takes more than one session, a big factor in how his evaluation turns out will be the influence of the mayor, Julie Moore Wolf. She works more closely with the city manager than any council member. She has an office about 20 feet away from the city manager's office and should be having some influence and input into the council agenda for the council meetings. I met with the city manager in the mayor's office at 2 o'clock every weekday afternoon, and obviously that constant contact gives the mayor more insight and understanding on critical issues and performance than a council member. Moore Wolf should certainly have influence in explaining some issues or questions in the closed session evaluation from a different perspective, from working directly with the city manager. as I mentioned in last week's column, because of the lack of experience on the part of some council members, the big changes that have taken place, and some more than usual public outrage, the evaluation may reflect as much on the council as it does on Gleason. Certainly, this evaluation will tell a lot about the council's overall confidence in Gleason, although, unless something drastic happens, the public won't know the results of the evaluation. From the news desk, city aggregation program renewed. The new residential electric rate for participants in the city's municipal aggregation program remains about 14% less than the current default rate for Ameren as part of a community electric supply program that has saved residents more than $5 million since its inception in 2013. Homefield Energy was recently selected to remain as the program's electric supplier by the city and more than 100 communities through a program renewal process in anticipation of electrical rates continuing a recent trend of increase in the coming months. The collective recently went out to bid prior to the June 2016 expiration of the current agreement with Homefield in an effort to lock in current rates at a lower rate than what is expected at contract expiration in June. And as part of the renewal, the new 36-month rate is 5.95 cents per kilowatt hour, is still considerably lower than the Ameren rate of 6.77 cents per kilowatt hour that aggregation non-participants would pay if not enrolled in another program. The new rate, as was expected, is higher than the current contract aggregation rate of 4.58 cents per kilowatt hour, with the price of electric expected to continue to increase in the coming months. Participants will continue to pay the current rate until June, after which time the new rate will become effective on the July or August Ameren bills. As part of the renewal, residents and small businesses may have begun receiving an opt-out notice in the mail from Homefield Energy to be utilized if they choose to be removed from the program. Residents do not need to do anything and will be automatically enrolled if they want to continue to participate in the program. There is no contract to sign and no enrollment fee. With Decatur's aggregation program, residents will not be called or visited by a salesperson. There is no penalty for not enrolling, and residents can opt out of the program at any time at no charge, which offers protection in the event that the Ameren rate ever falls lower than the city's aggregation rate. Participants will continue to receive one monthly bill from Ameren, Illinois, and are still eligible for all of the same programs, including budget billing, payment agreements, and energy efficiency programs. Ameren will continue to bill Little Heap customers, and PIP Energy Assistance Program participants will continue to receive assistance with energy bills from the state. Electric Marketing Program offers received via mail or promoted by salespeople via telephone or in person are not part of the Decatur Community Aggregation Program. Residents that have questions are encouraged to visit the Homefield Energy website at homefieldenergy.com or call 1-866-694-1262. You can also email the company at homefieldcustcare.dynergy.com. In a few upcoming events, there will be a blood drive at Eisenhower High School on April 18th. Eisenhower High School, located at 1200 South 16th in Decatur, will host a community blood drive on Monday, April 18th from 8:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. in the auditorium. To donate, contact Taryn Mills at 217-362-3132 or visit bloodcenterimpact.org and use code 60766 to locate the drive. Potential donors must be at least 17 years of age. 16 with parental permission form available through bloodcenter.org and weigh more than 110 pounds. A photo identification or Central Illinois Community Blood Center donor card is required to donate. For questions about eligibility, call CIBC at 1-800-747-5401. Donors who last gave blood on or before February 22nd are eligible to give at this drive. blood donation is a safe and simple procedure that takes about 45 minutes to 1 hour. Individuals with diabetes or controlled high blood pressure may be accepted as eligible donors. Herb Breads with a Meaning program on April 16th. Combining baking with history and gardening, Father Dominic, the bread monk, will demonstrate three breads which use symbolic herbs to send messages of compassion and support to those you love. The Herb Breads with a Meaning program will be held on Saturday, April 16th, 2016, from 1 to 3 p.m. at the Copper and Brass Room, 1300 South Madison Street in Clinton, Illinois. The renowned Father Dominic Garamone is known for his delicious bread recipes, baking tips, and inspirational programs. For questions or to purchase tickets for this event, call the Extension Office at 217-935-5764. Tickets for the event are $15, which includes an informative and entertaining presentation by Father Dominic, recipe samples, and door prizes. Seats are limited. The event is co-sponsored by DeWitt, Macon and Piatt Counties, Home and Community Education, and the University of Illinois Extension. University of Illinois Extension provides equal opportunities in programs and employment. If you need reasonable accommodation to participate in this program, please call the Extension Office at 217-935-5764. Over the wire and crime news from Urbana, Snyder trial testimony focuses on slang. In Urbana, for family members of Paige Mars, 19-year-old woman who was shot to death in 2015 on Easter night, Thursday was a difficult day to sit in the courtroom. They were warned by the lead prosecutor and judge that the third witness would be displaying photographs. But some of the women decided to stay, despite the agony of seeing pictures of their loved one with her face disfigured by a close-range shotgun blast. On the third day of the federal trial of Kelton Snyder, a 23-year-old Decatur man, for conspiracy to commit murder, prosecutors presented witnesses who explained in graphic detail how Mars was slain in a wooded area by Matthew Higgins Vogt, a close associate of Snyder's. If convicted by the jury, Snyder is facing a life sentence in the Federal Bureau of Prisons. He previously pleaded guilty to the armed robbery connected to this homicide, for which he will be sentenced to up to 20 years at an August 22nd hearing. Evidence was presented Thursday that showed that the 12-gauge shotgun used to take Mars' life was the same weapon Snyder wielded 3 days earlier to rob a clerk and customer at a Circle K store in Decatur. An employee of Decatur's South Water Treatment Plant testified that he was on his normal rounds the morning of April 6, 2015, checking the lagoons south of the Sangamon River. He spotted something unusual on the other side of the river. "I happened to notice Ms. Mars over there," the mechanic said. "I left the lagoons. I drove to the other side, to Lincoln Park, to see what I was looking at." He drove across the bridge about 8 a.m., heading for a parking area near the figure. "I wasn't sure it was a person," he thought, as he approached the scene to investigate. "Maybe someone was hurt or passed out or something." As he approached, he saw it was a woman fully clothed. "She was laying on her back with her feet pointed in the direction I was coming from," the mechanic testified. He stopped about 20 or 30 feet away and called out to her. "Hey, are you okay?" There was no response. She was still. He surmised that she was dead. It was kind of obvious, I think. He called 911 and waited until the police arrived. "Did you see anything else?" Assistant U.S. Attorney Catherine Boyle said. "Her vehicle was parked up there. It was into the road, backed up to the fence facing out," the city worker said. Detective Scott Klein, crime scene investigator for the Decatur Police Department, testified that the victim's vehicle, a 1998 dark green Ford Taurus, was found with two cell phones inside. A 20-gauge shotgun shell was found in the rear passenger area. Mars drove Snyder and Higgins' Vogt to and from the Circle K, U.S. 36 in Baltimore Avenue, about 2:30 a.m., April 3, 2015, to commit the armed robbery. She had no prior criminal record. Prosecutors alleged that Snyder conspired with Higgins' Vogt to slay Mars because Snyder believed she would report them to law enforcement. It was another who man reported to police and Crime Stoppers that Snyder was involved in the robbery a few hours before the murder occurred, testimony in the trial revealed. It is likely that Snyder and Higgins Vogt would have shortly been arrested for the robbery, which was captured on surveillance video, even if Mars remained silent. Prosecutors screened photos Klein took of the crime scene, which showed Mars lying face up in the middle of a path, her head closest to the river. She was about 85 yards south of the 500 block of West Lincoln Park Drive, just south of Greenwood Cemetery. There was a facial wound and a wound on her right hand that were really visible, Klein said, adding that the facial wound was apparently from a shotgun. Under cross-examination by Assistant U.S. Public Defender Elizabeth Pollock, Klein said he believed that Higgins Vogt took Mars out there and shot her, while Snyder was not at the scene. Dr. Scott Denton, Macon County Coroner's physician, testified that Mars suffered multiple wounds from 5 shotgun blasts at short range. He believes she was shot once in the back of the head, then fell to the ground. While she lay there, she was shot once in the mouth and 3 times in the chest. She said the first shot would have knocked her unconscious, and she would have been dead in a minute or two. Her right thumb was partially amputated, as she apparently tried to defend herself against the first shot. She died of multiple shotgun wounds, Denton testified. They were all potentially fatal. Any one of these wounds would have been fatal. Decatur Deputy Police Chief Cody Moore was called on to explain why Snyder is being tried in federal court. Under direct examination by Assistant U.S. Attorney Jason Bohm, Moore said there is a dedicated FBI office at the Decatur Police Department, and local and federal officers routinely work together. He said some criminal offenses can fall under state and federal jurisdiction. Moore said prosecutors decide whether a case is to be handled in state or federal court. As an example of interjurisdictional cooperation, a photo lifted from surveillance video of the Circle K robbery was screened. It showed a tattoo on the back of the neck of Higgins Vogt as he removed cash from the store's cash register. Moore said the FBI was asked to enhance that image on April 6. The trial will resume at 9:15 a.m. on Monday in the U.S. District Court in Urbana. On this day in history, in 1820, the Venus de Milo statue was discovered by a farmer on the Greek island of Milos. In 1864, the United States Senate passed, 38-6, the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, abolishing slavery. The House of Representatives passed it in January 1865, and the amendment was ratified and adopted in December 1865. In 1904, Longacre Square in Manhattan was renamed Times Square after the New York Times. In 1913, the 17th Amendment to the Constitution, providing for popular election of United States senators as opposed to appointment by state legislatures, was ratified. President Woodrow Wilson became the first chief executive since John Adams to address Congress in person as he asked lawmakers to enact tariff reform. In 1935, President Franklin D. Roosevelt signed the Emergency Relief Appropriations Act, which provided money for programs such as the Works Progress Administration. In 1946, the League of Nations assembled in Geneva for its final session. In 1952, President Harry S. Truman seized the American steel industry to avert a nationwide strike. The Supreme Court later ruled that Truman had overstepped his authority, opening the way for a 7-week strike by steelworkers. In 1961, a suspected bomb exploded aboard the passenger liner MV Dara in the Persian Gulf, causing it to sink. 238 of the 819 people aboard were killed. In 1973, artist Pablo Picasso died in Mougins, France, at the age of 91. In 1981, General of the Army Omar Bradley, he was from World War II, died in New York at the age of 88. In 1990, Ryan White, the teenage AIDS patient whose battle for acceptance had gained national attention, died in Indianapolis at the age of 18. Also, the cult TV series Twin Peaks premiered on ABC. In 1994, Kurt Cobain, singer and guitarist for the grunge band Nirvana, was found dead in Seattle from an apparently self-inflicted gunshot wound. He was 27. In 2006, the Rolling Stones made their debut in mainland China with a censored but still raucous concert in Shanghai. Harley-Davidson Incorporated also opened its first dealership in China. Eight members of the Toronto chapter of the Bandidos biker gang were found dead in a remote wooded area of a farmer's property in Shedden, Ontario, in Canada, and six Bandidos from Winnipeg were convicted in 2009 of murdering them. In 2011, congressional and White House negotiators struck a last-minute budget deal ahead of a midnight deadline, averting an embarrassing federal shutdown and cutting billions in spending. And in 2015, Dzhokhar Tsarnaev was convicted by a federal jury on all 30 charges against him in the Boston Marathon bombing, and found him responsible for the deaths of the three people killed in the 2013 attack and the killing of an MIT police officer 3 days later. He was sentenced to death on the following month. Thought for the day, provided by the newspaper, is from General Omar Bradley, who said, "The world has achieved brilliance without conscience. Ours is a world of nuclear giants and ethical infants." And finally, a new store is coming to Hickory Point Mall. The Bergner Store, Hickory Point Mall in Forsyth, is slated to begin carrying furniture again starting by the middle of next month. The location is one of 24 in the Bon-Ton Stores Incorporated chain that will be expanding into the furniture business. Bon-Ton operates other brands including Boston Store, Carson's, Elder Beerman, Herberger's, and Yonkers. The company plans to have furniture available in 62 of its locations by mid-year. Each store will feature a furniture collection and sleep collection, offering an assortment of bedroom, living room, dining room, and accent furniture, home entertainment, recliners, and motion furniture. The sleep collection will include a selection of brand-name mattresses and will offer delivery services, which includes unpacking, setup, and placement within a customer's home. Again, this has been Alfred Wallace with the Decatur Herald and Review and Tribune for Friday, April 8th, 2016, and I look forward to reading for you again very soon. Have a good day.